Sabrina George of New Comedy Radio, still interviewing Lucy Porter.
Still here.
Still here, still doing a thing. So just to leave stand-up comedy directly for a moment, because you've been doing incredibly different things, how did you get into One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Christian Slater? Had you done any acting before? Because I saw it and you were very good.
Well, I mean, I only had three lines, so it wasn't the kind of...
Yes, but you looked like a nurse.
Okay, well, you know, I've always thought, if life had gone differently, I would have liked to be in a more caring profession, really, but so it was my little chance to live out my nurse fantasy, which, you know, not in a dirty way, in a kind of wouldn't it be nice to be a nurse kind of way. But yeah, no, that came about because, I mean, that was real kind of, well, nepotism largely, I suppose. It was like just because they'd done a production of 12 Angry Men in Edinburgh, which had gone quite well with all comics in it, with like Dave Johns and
Eddie as well.
Was he?
See,
I don't think he was.
Or the one before that.
Anyway, but yeah, comics basically. And so then they were looking to do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and which Erin O'Neill had suggested. And just because like Erin O'Neill and Dave Johns and a bit of people I knew were doing it, and so they kind of said to the director, oh, there's a tiny nurse. Who do we know who looks like a tiny nurse? There we go, let's get her. And so I went in and did an audition for it. And yeah, and so I mean, it was just really lovely. It was such a sort of lucky break, really, because it was such a nice introduction to acting. Because I, you know, as a stand-up, you do kind of think, what are you going to do? Is there anything else you can do? Like, you know, obviously, I've always been a writer, and I've always thought when I get sick of doing stand-up, I'll try and get writing gigs again. And you know, but it was just quite nice to try something else and to go, oh, maybe the world of acting isn't closed to me. So yeah, but it was nice because I did only have three lines, so it was kind of nice to sort of learn a bit by watching everybody else who had far more to do than me. And I sort of felt like I learnt an awful lot. Like, we did it for 6 months, I think, no, 8 months in total. And it was quite hard, really, just doing the same thing every night. I think that I missed the spontaneity of stand-up an awful lot.
I was going to say, because the fabulous Catherine Tate was saying that she came into stand-up in order to be an actor, and she finally got the dream job with the RSC, and she didn't like it very much because she was doing someone else's script, someone else's directing, someone else's frog.
You know,
and it was like... So she's actually left it, and obviously, as we know, become incredibly successful with her TV series that she's done herself, which is fabulous, which actually does use acting skills brilliantly.
Well, I think that's, you know, it's often actors create the best roles for themselves. You know, I think if I was to do another play, what I'd really like to do is to try and write a play and then be in it. And I think that would be, you know, the next step for me, because I'm not confident that I could just step into somebody else's production and make it work, because I don't know if I've got the acting skills. Whereas I think maybe if I have a crack at writing something and write a part that I know I can do, and that I, you know, it'll be easy to remember the lines that I've written, then that would be kind of quite a nice next step to make. So that's what I might, because I was thinking if I do Edinburgh this year, what I might do is try and have a year off next year and maybe do a play instead. Because I did, like, somebody weirdly offered me a part in a play this year, and which I thought was amazing on the strength of seeing me do three lines and something else to offer me a bigger part. Because it was quite nice. But I just was, for one thing, I thought it's quite taxing to do a play and a stand-up show, because I'm very easily distracted. And I kind of ended up, when we were doing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I kind of think my own show suffered a bit, because I'm so eager to please and ridiculously kind of like, if there's a boss situation,
right in the sun,
then I'm kind of really like, I'm such a terrified little girl where I kind of was wanting to please the other people in the play rather than doing my own thing, kind of thing. So I didn't really concentrate as much on my own show as I should have done.
And how did you find it doing someone else's lines? I know it wasn't that much, but doing someone else's lines, someone else's vision of what you should be.
It was not, you know, I mean, I'd never realised the sort of the freedom that you have within acting, like, even if you've only got three lines, to kind of try and make a different way. And, I mean, it was ridiculous, like, doing the... I was so embarrassed, if anyone could have seen me doing the rehearsal process, where I'd go home at night and do my three lines all different ways. It was like me standing kind of going, no, 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 no. And it was just this ridiculous kind of like, what the hell are you doing in front of your mirror? But it was kind of, you know... It was nice taking something that someone else has done and interpreting it, because, I mean, I have written for other people, and it's always fascinating when you give people jokes and then... Yes?
Can I ask you what your role is? I've been searching around for someone to spread the role of.
And they appeared as if by magic.
The papers are inside there. And what was? How was it working with other comics, other stand-ups in that context, rather than in the green room chatting and then going off and being completely solo performer?
I think it made it much easier as an experience having other
was
comics
it?
Because we all kind of felt a little bit like we were getting away with it, and it was a bit of a cheeky sort of look at us in the West End, ridiculous. Who you know?
This is what one real actor.
There's a couple of real actors. Well, I mean,
well,
some
Christian
of the stand-ups
Slater.
Had trained.
Has he done stand-up?
Well, no, he did when we were doing the run. We did these comedy nights, which he compared, which was hilarious because we'd give him jokes, and it's always funny when you see people who aren't used to delivering gags, and you'd give him a joke, and he'd just butcher it completely because he hadn't quite understood, particularly because they were sort of quite English jokes as well, so he didn't quite understand where the punchlines were. But he did. He got really good by the end. We did about six, and he was a very competent compere. You'd have booked him for you know any of your provincial gigs, really, at the end of that. But yeah, no. He obviously is a proper actor, and Frances Barber, who's
she's
amazing,
so I forgot, yeah.
And
yeah.
Amazing to watch like her process. She's like just a legend, and to see how she made that character. Because you know we'd all read the script, and then to see what she'd done with it, and it was just totally different to what I had in my head. But totally amazing, and really worked. I think some of the other comics had done a lot of acting, like Mackenzie Crook had done quite a bit, and Owen O'Neill was, you know, some of them, which Phil Nichols, a trained actor. So, I mean, there was a mixture of levels of skills and competence and confidence, and we all sort of helped each other along and buoyed each other up, and we just had such good laughs around. So, well, I mean, it was just like
would
back
you like
to university.
Do more, apart from your own? Did you go for those two plays you were offered?
Well, no, there was one I really, really, really wanted to do, but I just kind of thought I just really can't afford to mess with my own show that much. But yeah, I would like to, just to try something new, because, you know, you can get a bit bored of just doing the circuit all the time, really. And it's, you know, you're travelling to all the same gigs, and even though, you know, most of them are lovely, it's just a bit samey, so it'd be nice to have a little
bit. It can become a bit 9-to-5-ish.
Yeah.
And what about your writing in other areas, like writing TV and radio?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing so much of that anymore, really, because I think, you know, I've started to just concentrate a bit more on my own stand-up, because I think, you know, I would like to get that as good as it possibly can be, and then I'll retire gracefully and concentrate on writing again, I think. But yeah, I mean, I used to do quite a lot of sort of writing by the yard for TV stuff, you know, like I did, you know, loads of sort of little clip shows and writing the links to those, and I mean, at the moment, I did Anthea Turner's Perfect Housewives, which was hilarious.
Did you?
Yeah, I did just the voiceover script for that. We're just tinkering with it. But that was quite funny because I have the worst, most messy, appalling, stinking pit of a flat. I'm really not housewife. I'm such a slob, and I really am. But that's kind of... I kind of felt quite good. I thought, well, I can turn my hands to this, even though I don't believe in any of it.
I can act the role of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I did tidy up a bit. I mean, I moved some of the dirty cups from one side of the room to the other, which I felt was my concession to housework. So, I mean, I'm sort of trying to keep my hands in and do bits and bobs and stuff. But, yeah, I mean, that's something that I would really like to do more of. Is, you know, I mean, I've always thought that, you know, I'm not going to do stand-up forever because I'm not, you know, I think unless you are a brilliant, brilliant stand-up, like a genius, like a, you know... every generation seems to spawn a couple of them, like, you know, your sort of Ross Nobles, Eddie Izzards, you know, Kitson, I suppose, from our generation, Peter Kay. You know, I kind of think that this, you know, I'm never going to be that good. I'm going to be better than I am now. I'm going to be a lot more competent and a lot more confident, I hope. And that's what I'm sort of striving for, is to be the best comic I can be. But I hope that I'll have this sort of sense to realise when that happens and then do something else, I think. And that might well be writing, I think.
And so somebody offered you a sitcom or something like that to be in?
Yeah, oh yeah.
You'd be happy with that?
Well, as long as it was something that I could sort of, you know, improvise a bit. And I mean, again, you know, what I really should be doing is writing a sitcom that I'd like to be in. But I haven't yet, because I don't know. I think I'm slightly fearful of failure, for one thing. So if you just don't do anything, then... can't fail.
Exactly.
And it is quite dispiriting when, I mean, because I did actually, I've written quite a few treatments for show ideas, either to sort of, well, present in, you know, author documentaries, things like that, where you'd be sort of fronting it. or, you know, little... I mean, I did once attempt a sitcom, but it was terrible. Looking back on it now, I go, my God, that was dire. But, you know, it's a learning process, isn't it? And it is quite dispiriting, kind of taking things around to people and facing constant rejection and, you know, and then getting bitter about things that do get commissioned. When you look at stuff, you go, why did you make that and not my thing? And, you know, that's kind of quite a hard process to go through, but I think, you know, I'm going to have to.
What about novel writing?
Yeah, I'm going to have started one.
You have?
Yeah. But again, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
And would that have a comedic element in it, or would you go completely the reverse and do a...
Well, I'd really like, I mean, what I read literary novels, and I don't read much lighter stuff. And I mean, because I was described once as a chick lit comic, which I, at the time, kind of, I read it and I took that as a massive insult, and then actually looked at it and went, of course I am, of course I'm a chick lit comic. Aww. There's just, you know, I mean, everything about me screams chick lit, and if I write a book, then it should really have a bright, colourful cover with a picture of a lady's legs on it. Exactly, yeah. But, you know, I mean, but then I think that, you know, you, I don't know, I mean, the novel that I'm writing, I'm kind of sort of pitching it as a literary novel, but again, as with my stand-up, I might be sort of pitching, sort of imagining that I'm Ian McEwan, and actually I'm Maeve Binchy, you know, so who knows, but...
Yeah, the Daniel Steele of England or something, yes.
Well, there's no shame in that as well. I mean, I think, again, it's finding your voice as an author as well as a comic, isn't it? You know, what's... You know, you can emulate the things that you really enjoy, or you can just sit down and write. And
I was
not
asked,
worry about it too much.
Someone called Noreen Herzog has written three incredibly important tomes on third world debt.
Uh-huh.
And the last one came out last year, IOU, and it's massive. And she's a fellow at Cambridge or Oxford or one of those, and she's on various Tony Blair think tanks at 27, and she's deeply important. And she saw me doing a gig, and she came after the gig, and she said, you know, could you help me write my, help me promote the book? You know, she had to go around to all these book reading things and talk about it and talk about third world debt. She said, could I go around and help her joke it up? And so I went round and sort of spent about, and I said, well, write out what you would do, and then I'll try and see what I can do. And it just couldn't really go anywhere, because she didn't understand the joke process.
Yeah.
And she didn't understand being personal. She was so academic that she understood, you know, how to extrapolate various statistics to come to whatever conclusion she needed to come to. And when I was saying, yes, but could you tell a little personal story about your debt or your... And she looked at me completely blank. I am not in debt. I've never been in debt. I do not understand the concept of debt. Right, okay.
Good for her.
Do you know a friend? Yeah. No. And it was fascinating just spending those 3 hours with her, just going...
Because I always think that everybody could do what I do.
Yes.
I mean, and I find it incredible. It's like, because my sister is... she's actually a doctor, but she's a consultant in addictive behaviour. And she's had loads of papers published, and it's great. She's a consultant in addictive behaviour. I sit there smoking and drinking. You know, something's gone wrong in this family. She can't cure her own sister. And she's sort of occasionally, when she's had talks to deliver, she said to me, "Oh, look, will you have a look at it and just see if you can sort of funny it up a bit?" Or, you know, we've tried. And she's quite... I mean, in life, she's quite funny, but when she's delivering a paper, it's just
another person emerges.
Trying to slot jokes into that, it just doesn't really work, and she just kind of, you know, and she doesn't quite get the timing, and, you know, God bless her, but, you know, it's I mean, in a way, actually, mate, because I've always been quite in awe of her, and I've always thought that, you know, this, she got all the brains, and I got sort of desire to be loved.
Chick-lit quality.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, but then there is something, you know, she's quite envious, I suppose, in a way, like when we sit and do that, she kind of goes, oh, I just wish, you know, I wish I could make it a bit more fun for everyone. And I'm like, yeah, I wish I could say something of any meaning or import or value.
Because I love going to I went to see Dr. Simon Singh. I don't know, you know him, he's a Radio 4 pundit. And I went to see a talk he gave on, I think it was The Improbable Theory. And don't ask me how I got into watching it, but it was fascinating, not only because the subject itself was fascinating. He was talking about, you know, the Nostradamus thing, and, you know, someone had found in the Bible, there was, what do you call it, if you did various codes through it, you could find out that they'd already predicted Princess Di's accident.
Oh, gosh, yes, yes, and yes. So, been,
yeah. And then from that he said, well, actually, you can find it in Harry Potter. And he yes. brought out, I don't, you've seen it, it's just brilliant. And what was so wonderful about it, why it was so digestible, was because there was fun, there was humour, and he was quite personal. He would talk about, you know, his favourite book, and he'd go, which at that moment was Harry Potter, and he said, you know, take any book big enough, you can find a prediction to anything if you follow various rules of the improbable theory. And he talked about, you know, the impact it had on the projected expenditure on HIV, that how they got it so wrong because they followed the incorrect improbable. And it was just really interesting, and I thought there are so many academics that do what they do brilliantly, but if they could just do a little bit of what we do, we'd all go, oh, we must all go and watch more academics talk.
Yeah, but I think that it's, I sort of feel sorry for academics now in that they do have to be entertaining, nothing's allowed to be boring anymore. And like, so I love, like, you know, on Radio 4, like In Our Time, and you listen to In Our Time, and you get the, you know, the ones who are sort of great. You know, I'm trying to think who I mean, Kate Moss is always quite a good one, isn't she, for sort of as a broadcaster and a, but also as an academic, you know, and it. And it is so unfair, I think, for, you know, all of these kind of professors and doctors and who are now expected to not only be massively knowledgeable, but also entertaining and fun, and everything's got to be digestible, and, you know, but it's true, you know, I mean, I feel like I've got a thirst for, you know, knowledge about science, and I mean, like, maths has always been my, I am kind of terrified of maths, and I've always had a real problem with it, but, you know, all of this sort of popular mathematics stuff that's around now, all these popular science books, things like, I was reading, have you read David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest? The thing about infinity, anyway, about the concept of infinity, and it's just, yeah, brilliant, really entertaining, really funny, and, you know, yeah, just absolutely astonishing that you can be so gifted in
two areas, in both the academic side and the and the presentation skills. Yeah, because I think it's something, again, that I hadn't really realised until working with someone like Noreen or various other people, that there is something else, that comedy is taken quite lightly.
Yes.
And because, I mean, another thing, I used to work in opera, which is deeply heavy subject most of the time, most people go there. I absolutely loved it. I loved the massiveness of it and the madness of it and the intensity and the passion. Mm. And anyway, when I started doing comedy, I was invited down to Glyndebourne. And I was in the sort of equivalent to the Royal Enclosure with all these terribly important cabinet ministers and whatever. And the show was dreadful. It was a real dog. It had gone horribly, horribly wrong. And I got there a bit late and I walked into this complete... You know, if it had been a comedy gig, you say it couldn't have been more dead.
Oh, yeah.
And the woman who knew me, she's one of the programmers, she just turned to me and she said, oh, Sabrina, can I introduce you to everybody? This is Sabrina, she's a stand-up comic. And immediately people were just like, oh, tell us your worst, your best, you know, whatever. And I actually entertained through the supper break for nearly an hour, just impromptu rubbish talking about stuff. And they introduced me to the guy who'd sponsored the tune of £300,000. And his name, I'll call him Mr. Ford because I can't remember his real name, and he was wearing a white linen suit, which in 9-1 times is wrong. He was American, it was wrong. He should have been wearing a penguin suit. And so...
I love that world of posh that I'll never understand.
It's fantastic. Yeah. And the butler's delivering, you know, grouse and stuff. Yeah. It was just so insane. And then we went back into the second section, which everyone was going into as if it was going to be an execution, which it turned out to be, and it was absolutely hideous. And he held the door open. I was the last person to walk into the theatre. And as he held open the door, he said, "Soul Sabrina, what's it like to leave one of them at the highest form of performing arts to work in one of the lowest forms of performing arts?" And I thought, I just worked my arse off for an hour for my supper.
And how thankless.
And how thankless. But I thought, actually, he's got a point. There is a point that we are viewed as... this sort of froth on things, which is
fools,
maybe this
really?
Urge to, yeah, we are the fools.
Which is, you know, I mean, I kind of think that but the best stand-up is where I think you have to acknowledge that we are kind of one rung above jugglers, and that will always be our place. But I think when you can, I mean, I think this is the thing, is that if you consider yourself to be an artist, and I mean, you know, I've had this conversation with so many comics about, you know, you just end up sounding really wanky and going, no, but I do, I think I'm an artist, and I don't know.
Creative.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think if you can marry this, you know, the passion of opera or theatre, and you know, taking comedy seriously always feels really wrong, and even sort of chatting like this about it and having that recorded and broadcast, I've always been sort of quite wary of, because I sort of think, you know, your old fashioned comics, like your mainstream comics, I've done interviews with them. I did a series called Funny Business for ITV where I interviewed, where like we sort of interviewed all these kind of old, you know, Jim Bowen and the Grumbleweeds and people like that, and they would never really dream of, in an interview situation, talking about the craft of what they do, or because it just sounds a bit pretentious, and it, you know, and they like to tell jokes, and every time they're on, they want to be entertaining and they want to be funny, and you know, obviously I can't do that, and I like talking about the craft of it because I do believe in it passionately, and I do think that when you marry that sort of passion that you get in the more legitimate arts to stand up, that is where the magic happens, and where you get people who are massively passionate about stand up, but you know, but at the same time recognise their need to kind of provide a laugh at the end of it all. And I mean, that's what we should all be aspiring to, really, I think, and that is what the sort of true nature and beauty of alternative comedy is that it's about trying to do something with comedy that is a bit more ambitious than just telling old jokes that everybody knows.
Well, I liken it a bit to the fools, which I've never found any real research on, but the hired fools in the courts during medieval times, and the professional fool was the only one that told the king the truth.
Yes.
And there's an element of that, but put it in such a digestible form that the king could accept it.
Yes.
And if they got it wrong, they literally conquered. They literally died. But that's sort of thing.
But if you get it right, then it, you know, yeah, you are sort of this beacon of truth. In it. I mean, what's the Jonathan Swift said? You know, happiness is the serene state of being a fool amongst knaves. And the, you know, the sort of childlike, innocent quality of laughter, and you know, the sort of relaxation and joy that you can bring whilst it, you know, you can sort of. You can be a much better person, you can be a much truer, nicer person if you do, you know, if you're a really good stand-up, then you can get away with saying anything, you can say anything no matter how unpalatable it is, and really touch people. And, you know, I mean, I find it amazing when I watch people who get people coming up to them after gigs kind of saying, I really find it funny, but it really made me think, and I just, you know, what you were saying about X or Y just, you know, it really reflected what I've always thought, but I've never heard anyone say it before. And I mean, that's what I think secretly deep down we all want this to be, not only hilarious but also profound geniuses and great, you know, the sort of the funny Bertrand Russell is how I would always like to, you know, imagine that I could be one day. And I don't think I can be, but it's something to strive for, isn't it?
Because my first one-woman show was in Edinburgh. I first did it in Melbourne, then I did it in Edinburgh, and it was postmodernism, comedy and me, and it was just telling, it ended up because again I set myself this challenge, this is what I find fascinating and interesting, and I'm a bit of an art tart and whatever, and it became incredibly hard because it was just like, no, you must use PowerPoint presentations, you must use visual images, and I was like, no, I'm just going to use the spoken word. And so I was really happy with the show, and this one kid, he was like this goth, and I think he was about 16, 17, and he came up to me afterwards and he said, my God, that's changed my life. And I just thought, I love you. And I thought, he probably hasn't, but I'm holding on to that. But, you know, this guy was like, God, you made me think so differently. You could be anything, couldn't you? And it was about self-creation and, you know, you say you're something and then you are.
Yes.
Unless somebody decides to find you out. And then, you know, I think Madonna is a great postmodern woman.
Yes.
That's what she's known for, is this ever-changing thing without any particular talent other than the one to endlessly recreate
herself. Yeah.
And I didn't use her as a model, I used myself much more because I thought that was, I'm much more interested in Madonna.
Yes, you are.
Oh, yes. But just tell, you know, the stories about, you know, I was living in New York and I was there illegally and I chose this name of De Rothschild, not realising what a cachet this had, and how it led me into this incredible sort of super world of the nightclub scene, and everybody thought I was a star, and I just decided to go with it. And I did that for a year, and so it's sort of stuff like that. And this kid, you know, from sort of, you know, welfare area of Edinburgh, and I'd got him and his mates in because I needed an audience, because I had reviewers in. And the others just sat there looking glum, but he was just absolutely rapt at the whole thing and came out and said this, and I was just like, that was just such a feeling of satisfaction.
Well, you'd rather have one of those, really, than, I mean, I don't know, this is the problem, isn't it, is would you rather have one of those and an audience of people who don't really get it, or just have the instant gratification and joy of a room full of people going, oh, she was quite funny, wasn't she? Yeah, that was all right.
That's a nice way to pass an hour.
I mean, and what you want is both, isn't it? Mm. Is you want people laughing at breweries.
I was going to say, what is
it? Because I think it's very difficult to... I mean, like, art, this whole concept of life-changing art, because for me, you know... stand-up comedy is what changed my life, and it was finding stand-up comedy was the thing that, because I would never have thought of myself as an artist, or you know, even as a writer, I kind of always thought, well, yeah, I can write funny things, but I just couldn't see where that was going to lead. I thought, oh yeah, I'll be a journalist, I'll be something, but I never found anything that I felt truly comfortable with. But then when I started going to watch stand-up, I remember going to see a gig, seeing Sean Hughes at some, it was a rock venue that I used to, because I used to go and see a lot of indie bands, and so just happened to sort of see, oh, this Sean Hughes is on. I didn't really know much, you know, I'd been listening to stuff on the radio, but I'd never made that leap from thinking, I've heard it on the radio, I could go and see it live. And it just, I think for a lot of people, they watch stand-up on telly or they watch comedy on telly and they love it, but they just, you know, I think as comics you just don't realise what a big leap it is for people to go, why don't we go and see it live, why don't we see what that's like. And I'd never really thought about it, and ended up seeing Sean Hughes. And I mean, that was a proper life-changing event, where I sort of watched it, and it was like I was rapt for an hour and a half or whatever, and then, and I think that was probably where the seed was planted, even though I wasn't really conscious of it at the time, of actually, maybe this is something that I could do. And I mean, everything that sort of followed on from that, like, you know, it was always seeing someone live and going, like, oh, that's amazing, you know, in a way that I haven't really, you know, there's a couple of plays that I think have profoundly affected the way that I think about life. And you know, and a few films actually. I've made some, like, there was a film. Oh gosh, what was it called? It was a Canadian film called Last Night, which was about how people spend. They know the world's going to end and how they spend their life last night on Earth. And it was just quite a sweet little film. But that, me and my flatmate at the time, we came out and both went, right, that's it. And I, you know, we both ended up sort of giving up our jobs because we were sort of thinking, oh, you know,
this was your last night.
That's, if this was our last night, how shitty would we feel waking up? You know, just sort of going through it, going, okay, I never did the things that I really wanted to do. But I mean, it is very rare, I think, like you know, I think we can sometimes overestimate the potential of art to change people's lives. And certainly, I mean, because with stand-up, you, in some ways it makes it more profound when it does happen. I think, like, for that boy that you're talking about, you go along to stand-up and you don't expect to hear anything other than some jokes that are going to keep you entertained for a while. So when you do, it has a very profound impact, but more often than not that doesn't happen. And if you try for that, I think often you can fall flat on your face. And that's what I'm slightly worried about, is sort of trying to, again, you know, it's a sort of fear of failure thing, but trying to sort of make some sort of profound statement through your comedy and failing is just the most embarrassing, you know. There's nothing more embarrassing is than kind of intellectual posturing that isn't quite thought through well enough, or you know, because I know I'm not an intellectual, but it's what I would strive to be. I'm just really wary of you know, trying to create some sort of sense of gravity to what I do if it doesn't really exist and if I can't back it up. So I don't know what I'm trying to say there, but I just kind of think, yeah, I'm at a slightly uneasy position of feeling like I'm at an age where I want to be leaving some kind of legacy to the world, or you know, some sort of wisdom that will help people or will change people, and you know, but I'm not entirely sure whether I'm capable of doing that, really.
Well, I think, as you say, whether it's one person or 3,000, I think that's something that I feel is the huge privilege,
yeah,
I have doing what I do. Whether it's encouraging someone else who I think is brilliant who might be lacking a bit of confidence, or whether it's, you know, just whatever in any area, or just incite that. And again, maybe that's the people please inside of me, but it's just such a buzz when you get someone saying, I'd really like to do it, and you go, right, do it.
Yeah, I mean, that is the lovely, you're absolutely right, that when people come up to you at gigs and go, oh, God, I've always thought about doing stand-up, and you go, oh, yeah, you should do it. And they, you know, and they feel like they can approach you, and you know, and you'll give them hints and tips, and you know, and that's something that I would always try and do. Because I think that what, you know, I think when you get really brilliant, amazing stand-up comics, it's just such a joy, you know, to think that you had any hand in doing that, even if they've just seen you and gone, oh, I could do better than that. Really, she's not all that. I think I might give it a go then, you know. So I think just the fact of getting up and doing stand-up again, you know, going back to doing the Puppetry of the Penis tour, where it was largely women coming to see me, and you know, women who said, we've never been to see stand-up before, and also like a couple of times women going, never thought that women, you know, the only women I've ever seen doing stand-up have been Victoria Wood and Jo Brand. I didn't realise that there were women
doing stand-up.
On the
telly, yeah. Which I think is terribly sad.
Yeah.
It's very, very sad. But I emceed a horrible gig the other week, 2 weeks ago in central town, and I didn't think I was doing a holding game because it was a core group of about 12 really bouncy blokes, and I thought there was something to do with the police. And I was trying really hard not to talk to them. In fact, the only talking I was doing was shut up. You know, be quiet, sit down, shut up, be quiet. And they were quite witty amongst each other, and I knew there must have been some sort of service thing, because I've got this theory that people in the extreme ends of the service area, like ambulance doctors and A&E and police, etc., they have to develop such a wit, and certainly in this country, to cope with the crises that they deal with. And so I just got this vibe of them, and I just spent the whole time, will you shut up, these are open spots, and most of them are terrified, and some of them are good, some of them weren't. But trying to prepare the stage area for some sort of focus. So I didn't think I was doing anything at all, I could just say shut up. And at the end of it, these guys came up, sort of as one group, and just said that was fantastic, we didn't know this was here, this is brilliant, we want to come back again. They said, you know, you were brilliant. I was like, whatever. And I said, what do you guys do? And they were all part of the bomb squad.
Oh, really?
And they'd been involved in clearing the tube and the buses in last summer in London. And it was, again, it sort of made me think, well, to them, they have their own wit and they have their own humour for a very specific purpose. And to see someone just inanely wittering and they all said, you know, we couldn't have done that. We could never sit there and tell jokes for 5 minutes. We could just throw banter around.
I bet if they did do stand up, it would be fascinating, though. That's sometimes
when you talk to
people. If they
allowed themselves to really talk about it.
Yeah. It's funny how narrow I still think the. You know, often when you're in the dressing room, you do sort of look around and you think, you know, the sort of diversity. I mean, there is sort of not as much diversity in stand-up as one might hope for, because I think people think it's a scary thing to get into, so it tends to be people who at least feel some kind of right to express themselves anyway, so it is kind of like largely middle class or, you know, sort of people who have always been taught that their opinion is actually quite important or that they have a right to express their opinion. And you know, you do sort of feel like the sort of disenfranchised masses still aren't being really catered for in the comedy world, because it's like working class. You know, there's very few working, truly working class comics still. It's a very middle class, very white,
male orientated thing. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I don't know how you change that. We need some kind of, you know, quota system. But
well, yes, that's a whole other area, isn't it? We have a quota system. I mean, I tried the club I had running for a while. I had that going where I tried to get, you know, as broad a disparity of comics as possible.
Yeah.
And I think it always made for an interesting night at the very least, even if maybe they weren't that funny. Most of the audience seemed to really respond to it. But it was bizarre how the comics didn't see it that way.
No, I bet they didn't.
But they were just like, why are you bringing him on? He dribbles. You just go, well, that's because he...
I went to see a brilliant night in, you know, it's a weird thing, isn't it? As a sort of, like, well, there was this brilliant night anyway in, where was it? The Galway Comedy Festival, and they had Des Bishop, who's an American comic living in Ireland. He has been doing this show where he goes around to sort of the roughest areas in Ireland and gets people to do stand up, people who would never think about doing stand up. And it is actually really, the thing is, it is actually really good when you see, because I saw the showcase of some of the people who've been on this TV show, and they all had like genuinely sort of different, unique voices, and it was kind of just like, well, this is a lot more interesting than people talking about their PlayStation.
The underground and
you know,
on
I mean,
and,
but yeah. You know, I kind of don't know where I'm going with this really, because you know, on the one hand, you sort of feel like it's a bit patronising, going, oh God, you know, ordinary people have such brilliant stories to tell, but then I don't know, but then I do sort of feel a little bit self-conscious about the fact that. You know, I mean, I'm basically, comedy audiences are largely white male and middle class, comedy performers are largely white male and middle class, or, you know, increasingly more women, but, you know, you sort of feel like it's a bit of a middle class club sometimes, which, you know, comedy used to be actually a lot more genuinely working class. I was listening to there was a radio documentary on Radio 4 the other day about the history of the alternative circuit, and I think maybe it was Alexi Sale.
Yes.
Just talking about, oh, you know, you're actually putting a lot of, you know, actually that circuit put a lot of working class comics out of employment,
business,
you know, because it, you know, stand-up was a working class art form that's been kind of hijacked by college graduates and the middle classes now. But then again, there were never many women, there were never many black people, you know, it's, sort of, it's just white men of a different class, I suppose.
Yeah, I think whenever there's large quantities of money, a certain fraternity move in.
Yeah, yeah. It's terrifying, the amount now of sponsorship in comedy, and I think there is really there's a new alternative circuit emerging, isn't there? I think of, you know, there's your kind of club gigs and there's the sort of the circuit that I operate on, but I think that there is, it's like there's now a sort of fringe at the end of the fringe. I think that there, you know, now you've got things like, I guess, I mean, the book club in part would be part of that, sort of things that mix more character comedy and more sort of less mainstream stand-up, I suppose, and that's, I think that's definitely something that's going to get stronger in the next couple of years. It's going to be a more underground comedy scene again, because it has really, you know, alternative comedy is now mainstream, definitely.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, on that note, I think we'll wind up. Thank you very much, Lucy.
I'm actually quite sunburnt now. I think I've taken a bit of colour.